And what about the drink, Judge?
The drink?
Did you have an alcohol problem when you sat on Rami Gandalf's case?
No.
You weren't drinking. He was skeptical. Justifiably, she knew.
I drank, Arthur, but not to excess.
Not at that time.
She flexed her tongue a bit in her mouth. Governed by common understanding, Raven had missed his mark. She could correct him or say never and see if Arthur eventually wandered to the right place. But she remembered the instructions every skilled lawyer offered in preparing a witness. Answer the question you are asked, briefly, if possible. Do not volunteer.
No, not at that time.
She tossed her cigarettes into her suede shoulder bag and snapped it authoritatively. She was ready to go and asked if Raven was finished.
I have a personal question, he said at last. If you don't mind, I keep wondering why you came back here. I mean, you're like me, right? Single, no kids.
My mother was dying, and the Bureau of Prisons was willing to give me credit for helping to take care of her. It was the Bureau's choice, frankly. Like other answers she'd offered Raven, this one, too, was comfortably incomplete. She'd left prison broke. The government and her lawyers had taken everything. And Duffy Moldauer, her sponsor in the parlance of 12-step programs, had been willing to offer her a place to stay.
Once my community release time is over, I'll probably ask to move.
She's gone, your mother?
4 months ago.
I'm sorry. My father died 3 months ago, and I'm still a wreck, Arthur said. His short brow was briefly molded by pain. He never stopped making me crazy. He was probably the most nervous human being ever to walk the earth. Anxiety should have killed him years ago, but, you know, all that hovering and clucking, I always felt how much he cared.
Raven's eyes, stilled by recollection, rose to her.
Why am I telling you this? He asked.
Probably because you think someone like me has nothing better to do, she answered. For a moment, the pure brutality of the remark seemed to stun them both. A quiver passed through Raven's doughy face. Then he straightened and closed one button on his coat.
I'm sorry to have bothered you. I made the mistake of thinking we had something in common.
Intent on collecting herself, Jillian found her cigarette pack in its leather case in her purse and lit up again. But her hand shook as she struck the match. Across the table, she could hear the zipper on Raven's briefcase.
I may have to subpoena you for deposition, he said.
Touché, she thought.
And tear her apart, of course, once he got the opportunity.
Deservedly, too.
Will you accept service by mail?
He asked how to reach her without going through the federal court probation office, and she told him she was living in the basement apartment in Duffy Moldauer's house. Duffy, a former Roman Catholic priest, had been the chief state defender in Jillian's courtroom years ago and, as a result, Raven's constant opponent. Yet Arthur did not so much as bother with polite inquiries about Duffy's well-being.
I had no reason to be rude to you, Arthur.
That's all right, Jillian. I know. You always thought I was boring.
She smiled bitterly, but she felt some admiration for Arthur. He'd grown up. He could dish it out now. And he was on the mark. Nonetheless, she tried again. I'm not very happy, Arthur, and I suppose it makes me unhappier to see the people I used to know. It's a painful reminder. Without response, Raven rose, stating simply that he would be in touch and proceeded toward the door. Watching him exit, she caught sight of her reflection in the cheap mirrors, veined in gold, which boxed the posts supporting the restaurant ceiling. She was often startled to see herself because, generally speaking, she looked so much better than she felt. She was tall with strong posture, and even time didn't take its toll on good cheekbones. The fashionable details, a fitted twill suit, a strand of pearls, a hacked-down hairdo spiked with mousse, supported the composed bearing that seemed to radiate from her. It was a look she'd assumed in her teens, as false as the self-portrayal manufactured by most adolescents, but it had never been forsaken, neither the appearance of outward command nor the sense of wanton fraud that went with it. Certainly, Jillian had deceived Arthur. she had answered misleadingly, then lashed him to ensure he didn't linger to learn the truth. Raven had been led astray by rumor, the vicious talk about her that had circulated years ago when her life collapsed. They said she was a lush, but that wasn't so. No, Jillian Sullivan, former deputy prosecuting attorney and then judge of the Superior Court, was a smackhead, a stone doper, a heroin addict. She did not shoot. She never shot up. As someone who treasured her appearance, even in her most desperate state, she would not deface herself. Instead, she smoked heroin, chased the dragon in the lingo, tooted. It had started with a guy. Isn't that how it always starts? Toby Elias was a gallant, handsome, twisted creature, an assistant in the Attorney General's office, whom Jillian had some thought of marrying. One night he'd returned home with a hit of heroin lifted from a case he tried. It was the taste one doper had offered another as a prelude to a sale, introduced in evidence and never returned after the verdict. They chipped, snorted the first night, and reduced the quantity each night thereafter. It was an unearthly piece, but nothing that required repetition. A month later, Toby stepped in front of an 18-wheeler. She never knew if it was an accident. He was not killed. He was a body in a bed for months, and then a dripping wreck in a wheelchair. And she had deserted him. She wasn't married to the man. She couldn't give her life when he hadn't promised his. Yet it was a sad turning point. She knew that now. Toby had never recovered, and neither had she. 3 or 4 months after that, she'd pinched a taste on her own for the first time. During a trial in front of her, she allowed the defense chemist to open the sealed evidence bag to weigh how much heroin had been seized. The rush seemed more delicious now. She forged opportunities, ordered tests performed when none had been requested, encouraged the prosecutors to lock their exhibits in her chambers overnight rather than tote them back to the PA's office. Eventually, the tampering was discovered, but a courtroom deputy was suspected and banished to an outlying precinct. After that, she had to score on the street, and she needed money. By then, she was taken for a drunk. As a warning, she'd been transferred from the Felony Trial Division to Common Pleas, Tort Court, where she heard personal injury cases. There, somebody knew. One of those dopers she'd sentenced had recognized her, a pretty white lady lurking in the bombed-looking blocks less than a mile from the courthouse. He told the cop he snitched to. From there, word traveled to the presiding judge in Common Pleas, a villain named Brendan Toohey, and his henchman, Rollo Kosick. Kosick visited her with the news, but offered no corrective. Just money. Take his advice from time to time about the outcome in a case. There would be money. And she complied, always with regrets, but life by now was the misery between hits. One night there was a knock, a scene out of 1984 or Darkness at Noon. The U.S. attorney and FBI agents were on her doorstep. She'd been nailed. For bribery, not narcotics. She cried and blabbed and tooted as soon as they were gone. After that night, she turned to Duffy, her current landlord, a recovering alcoholic with long experience as a counselor from his days as a priest. She was sober when she was sentenced, her habit the only secret that survived a period in which she otherwise felt she'd been stripped naked and marched in chains down Marshall Avenue. She was not about to revive all of that now, surely not for Arthur Raven, or for a murderer who had been beast enough to rape the dead.